This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. In the early 1800s, Charles Darwin traveled to the Galapagos Islands to observe the natural world. And his research there, of course, eventually led to his theory of natural selection, which in turn changed the study of biology. But Darwin's work didn't just come from the Galapagos. For years after his trip, he performed unorthodox and innovative experiments, oftentimes in his own backyard. Joining us now is James Costa. His forthcoming book looks at the unique experiments that helped define Darwin's life outside the Galapagos Islands. The book is called Darwin's Backyard: How Small Experiments Led to a Big Theory. James Costa is a professor of biology at Western Carolina University, and he's going to be talking about his book next Wednesday at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville, but first joins me from partner station Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Jim Costa, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Good to have you here. You've written a number of books on Charles Darwin. What interested you in this story, the backstory, I guess we should say, of, in his own backyard?
Well, the backstory occurred to me when I was working on an earlier project, an annotated version of The Origin of Species. And, you know, I had taught that book for some years and had been working on a kind of annotated version to help my students, you know, better understand the book, and realized that, you know, so many of the interesting arguments in that book were based on these curious experiments that Darwin was conducting, as you mentioned, often literally in his backyard. And I sort of filed that away. I thought that that would be an interesting story in itself to help better understand, you know, how Darwin came to his ideas.
Give us an idea. What were some of these experiments?
Oh, there are so many. In The Origin of Species itself, Darwin had experiments like little biodiversity plots in his yard, a little lawn plot where he would, you know, pull up everything and then, you know, monitor, you know, little seedlings as they came up, mark them with wires. And later in life, you know, his son helped him devise a kind of a millstone with a micrometer device to measure the very slow subsidence of the millstone by the undermining by earthworms. You know, he was interested in the orchids that grew in his woods. He chased bees around. He was interested in so many things.
Take us back to his roots now. What type of child was he growing up? You write that he had a fairly privileged background, right?
He did. He had a fairly privileged background. You know, he grew up in a pretty well-off family. His father was a well-respected physician. He grew up in the market town of Shrewsbury. His grandfather before him was also a well-known physician and actually a best-selling poet in his day, you know, in the 1780s and 90s. On his maternal side, his mother was a Wedgwood, and his maternal grandfather was Josiah Wedgwood I, the founder of the great Wedgwood Pottery Works. So he certainly had a very privileged upbringing.
And his nickname growing up was Gas?
Was Gas, yeah.
It was mine, you know, too, but I think for different reasons. But tell us
for
about
different reasons. Well, we do joke. Darwin, you know, has something of a flatulence problem later in life, you know,
uh-huh.
his dyspepsia. But in those early days, you know, he was just expansively curious. He and his older brother, you know, as many kids will do, they just had a little home laboratory, and they did all sorts of smelly chemistry experiments. That's how he got his nickname.
And he's something of a collector as well. And, of course, this was the age when collecting and naming things in the world of science was really what science was all about, right? So give us that.
Very much so.
Put him in that context for us.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, you know, probably late 18th century into the 19th century, you know, a real mania for natural history, collecting of shells or feathers, say. Botany, you know, was very popular. And certainly Darwin, you know, like so many of that time, was caught up in kind of collecting mania, even as a very, you know, young person. But that was manifested maybe most interesting ways when he was a college student. There was a kind of beetle collecting mania at that time among the privileged set. You know, the idea of having, you know, a fine collection of rare and unusual beetles. It was almost a blood sport among some of them.
Yeah, you say they actually, the wealthier among the students would actually hire, you know, beetle hunters for them. Is that right?
They would, yeah. And Darwin did as well. Yeah. He did a fair bit of his own collecting, but he wasn't above, you know, kind of buying specimens from others, and actually had an altercation at one point when he realized that one of his suppliers was sort sort of selling some of the choice specimens, giving first pick to others. You know?
Hot Beatles. Well, anyway, so now, and he's very young when he actually takes that that fateful and famous voyage on the HMS Beagle, right?
Yeah, he was just 22. He was young. He was fresh out of college. He graduated from Cambridge University. He was at Christ College. And it was unusual in some ways that someone so young, you know, not really a seasoned naturalist or professional by modern standards, would be chosen to go on a trip like that.
The captain of the ship was a little skeptical, though he found some kinship in that there was a class camaraderie there, but then he was a little bit worried about the phrenology of Darwin. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. Captain Fitzroy, Robert Fitzroy. Yeah, he was something of a devotee of phrenology and this idea that you could sort of tell from the, you know, bumps on people's heads or maybe their facial features, you know, aspects of their character. And Darwin later joked about that in his autobiography. He sort of commented on how it was owing to the shape of his nose, you know, that Fitzroy came very close to sort of nixing him from the trip.
But he did go, and we should talk about the evolution, if I may, of his own understanding of the theory that he became famous for. He initially saw himself as a geologist, right?
He did. He was really fired up with geology. I mean, geology, you know, was a very up-and-coming, very hot and exciting science at that time. But 1830 saw the publication of the first volume of a three-volume set called The Principles of Geology by the geologist Charles Lyell in Britain. And it just can't be overstated how important that was in really sort of changing the whole worldview, a sense of how you can read landscapes and how you can infer, you know, antiquity and Earth's processes. And Darwin was truly fired up by that book. In fact, Fitzroy had given him as a gift the first volume when it was published, just as the Beagle was about to embark on this voyage that was to take him around the world. And he very, very definitely considered himself a geologist and decided that he would be in a great position to make observations to corroborate some of the theories that he was reading in Lyell's book.
But this is interesting because if you talk about this science as collecting and naming, you're really on the threshold of two very different approaches to science. One that is a kind of taxonomy, right? Let's just collect all the things that we know about and fill our heads with that knowledge. And then the other that sees the world as a very dynamic kind of place where the lessons are being learned and changed all the time. And there he is on that very threshold.
Absolutely. You know, you need to understand what's there and begin to get a very deep appreciation for pattern before you can begin to ask the relevant questions about process. And so you can kind of think of that kind of natural history naming phase as kind of figuring out what's out there, how is it distributed, what are its characteristics, how do we understand these things, and then begin to ask these higher level questions. Well, why do we see things as we see them, and begin to puzzle that out and begin to connect dots.
Was that an aha moment for him that switched from the what to the why, or was it a kind of a gradual process?
You know, I think it was gradual, but there was apparently an aha moment with Darwin. You know, he had collected widely, not just in geology, when he was on the Beagle voyage. And, of course, as I mentioned earlier, he was not a seasoned naturalist. So a lot of his specimens were sent back to Britain and were being described by specialists in various fields, you know, in ornithology, in geology, paleontology. He came to understand, really through the efforts of others, just how important some of these discoveries and collections were. And he did begin to connect those dots. And apparently, historians are convinced now that right about March of 1837, so about 6 months or so after returning from that voyage, suddenly he sort of had this aha moment that, you know, the only thing that would, you know, maybe cogently explain these different patterns that the various specialists were telling him he had found with his specimens, the only thing that would explain those things was this idea that species can change over time.
And he was not alone in that. There were other theories of evolution that were making their way into print at the very time that he was having these thoughts, right?
Yes, absolutely. You know, the idea of evolution was certainly not original with Darwin. He, you know, he really resisted the idea. You know, he was not really very sympathetic to the idea. In the late 18th century, we had the great French naturalist Lamarck come up with a kind of evolutionary speculative theory. His own grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, he sort of dabbled in evolutionary speculations a la Lamarck. In the 1840s, in fact, in Britain, there was yet another kind of evolutionary speculator that published a book anonymously called The Vestiges of the Natural History of Creation, its own brand of a kind of transmutation, as they called evolution in those days. So the idea had certainly been kicked around for really probably a couple hundred years prior to Darwin.
And you write that seeing it in print, something that had been knocking around in his own mind for a while, but seeing someone else sort of come out with this in print close to his trip or not long after his trip to the Galapagos really lit a fire, didn't it?
It did. You know, it's interesting, the effect of the vestiges, you know, it sort of did the service of putting the idea of evolution, or again, as they called it, transmutation in those days, on the lips of everyone. But at the same time, this was considered to be a really disreputable idea, and it was really lambasted. It's hard to imagine today a book being published that would be considered so odious that, you know, just uniformly, you know, clergy, naturalists, politicians, you know, everyone would sort of have to weigh in and denounce this scientific book. But that's what happened with Vestiges, and it may have played a role in Darwin's decision to hold off and not go public with his theory, even though he had it well formulated by the time that book came out.
But as you point out, what Darwin's real contribution was is not so much the theory that there is this kind of this change over time, which had been abroad for, as you suggest, for a while, but the mechanisms. And he really focused on the how of evolution, which is what transformed the theory, and I think why we know him, right?
Yes, absolutely. And as I try to impress upon my students, you know, although there's an assumption today that, you know, we equate the name of Darwin with evolution, the concept wasn't original with him. What was original was, you know, he and his colleague Alfred Russel Wallace independently first came upon this mechanism, this idea of, that Darwin named natural selection as a driver for diversification of varieties and species.
Now, the book is called Darwin's Backyard, and we're talking about some of the quirkier experiments he performed. And you have some of those experiments, a kind of how-to, news you can use, science for the masses. Mm-hmm. Give us an idea. The duck feet experiment is actually my favorite. Maybe you can tell us how that goes. Because we can do this now in our own backyards or at a pond.
We can, yeah. I had this idea, this sort of epiphany early on in thinking about Darwin's, you know, penchant for what he called experimentizing, that so many of these little experiments that he conducted were really very straightforward. They were very simple. They didn't require any kind of fancy, you know, equipment, that anyone could really do these in their backyard, or they could be done in schools, you know, for example. And the duck feed experiment is an especially fun one that when I've taught classes on this subject, and educators and students have tried this, my own kids have tried this, and it's great fun. And essentially, Darwin had been thinking about how organisms become distributed as we see them. How do they move around? He was interested in how remote oceanic islands became colonized, for example. And on land, thinking about lakes and ponds as sort of islands on the land, he got to wondering, well, how do, you know, aquatic organisms get distributed? And logically, you might think, well, they must be carried in some way, especially if they can't survive out of water for any length of time. And that's straightforward. It's logical. It makes sense. And yet there was just no evidence one way or another. So in his characteristic way, he thought, well, I'll give this a try. And so in an experiment, he took, severed duck's legs and duck feet, and presumably they're eating the ducks, of course. But he had a tank of snails a little aquarium with snails, and he called it his snailery. And he would dangle these ducks' feet in the tank and see if any aquatic snails would climb aboard. And if they did, once he pulled out the feet, you know, set them on his mantle and just kind of see how long these little snails could live. And thinking, well, if they could live for, let's say, 23 hours, you know, well, how far might a duck fly in 23 hours? Because he's imagining ducks sleeping, dangling their feet in the water, snails climb on board, and then they're like, you know, these stowaways. They get carried, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles to the next pond. And my version of this, of course, doesn't involve actual ducks' feet. But it was great fun to design a very simple model using wooden dowels and a little ping pong ball or a bobber to help as a float and a little fabric duck foot. You know, you can cut out in the I give a little template. You can cut out a little bit of fabric in the shape of a duck's foot. A little weight on the bottom, attach a line, and you can cast the duck's foot in a lake or a pond and sort of go fishing for aquatic organisms.
Duck feet fishing, that's a first on this show, and we do appreciate it. And, of course, fish eggs, too, get caught in birds' feet, and then that's another way that the fish eggs can be taken from one to a new lake and a new pond. But this is a great experiment. You can sort of imagine going to dinner at this guy's house, where you show up and there's a bunch of duck feet and snails hanging from the mantle, and, you know, care for a little aperitif. Anyway, what we're going to do now, we're out of time, and I want to hear some more experiments, so they're just going to have to read your book. But thank you so much, James Costa, the author of Darwin's Backyard, How Small Experiments Led to a Big Theory. Thank you, Jim.
My pleasure. Thank you, Frank.
James will speak about his book next Wednesday at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville. You can find out more details at our website, stateofthings.org. James Costa, professor of biology at Western Carolina University. Our program, The State of Things, is produced by Anita Rausch, Charlie Shelton Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. In North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.